loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In this hour, we take a look at two major stories. First, we continue our regular segment, which we do every Tuesday, called Women and Society with Dr. Hannah Dickinson. And then we continue another weekly series called False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines. 84 protesters were arrested in a police crackdown on a demonstration in Sacramento, California last night. Demonstrators were voicing their outrage at the district attorney's announcement that there would be no charges in the police killing of Stephon Clark last year. Whistleblower Chelsea Manning's challenge against a subpoena to testify before a grand jury in Virginia was rejected by a judge today. It's widely believed that the grand jury in question is targeting WikiLeaks and Julian Assange. Manning has vowed to continue to fight in court against the subpoena. Lockheed Martin secured nearly $1 billion from Saudi Arabia today as part of a deal to sell the kingdom the highly advanced THAAD missile system. Arms sales to Saudi Arabia have come under increasing scrutiny in response to the brutal war on Yemen and the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Lockheed Martin stands to make up to $15 billion in total from the missile sales. Three explosive devices were mailed to transportation hubs in London today. Police say the packages contained small incendiary bombs. Two airports and a train station were targeted. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to our regular segment, which we do every Tuesday, called Women and Society with Dr. Hannah Dickinson. In this weekly segment, we talk about the major issues, challenges, and struggles facing women in all aspects of society. Hannah Dickinson is a professor, and she is an organizer with the Geneva Women's Assembly. Professor Dickinson joins us from Geneva, New York, and we're joined here in studio by Nicole Roussel, a Sputnik news analyst and a producer of this show. Hannah, Nicole, welcome back.
Thanks.
Happy to be here.
You're in Geneva. Is it snowing?
Sure is, every day.
Again, I was telling Nicole that when you're from Western New York, you're just kind of used to the snow, Nicole.
Nope.
I know you're from
Virginia.
Warmer parts of the country.
It doesn't snow as much or at all, which is so much preferred.
Yeah.
Very much preferred.
Well, that was an extremely interesting introduction about weather. Let's talk about something more important, like International Women's Day and some of the other big issues this week, Professor.
I mean, much like weather, this impacts everyone. You know?
Okay. All right.
That's right.
All right, Hannah, go ahead. Where do we want to start?
I think we should start by talking about International Women's Day. This is, I think, hands down my favorite holiday because, of course, it's not only a holiday or it's the best kind of holiday, the kind where we get to talk about politics and women's rights and the ways we're fighting back. And that's because it's a day that has socialist origins and a long socialist history that I think it's really important for us to remember. So this day doesn't just turn into another Hallmark holiday.
Well, I actually remember when International Women's Day was revived in the United States because it was revived as a matter of intervention by young women in 1970 who held a demonstration in New York City in solidarity with women prisoners in Manhattan. And it was a really major event. It was at the time that there was a big radical turn in politics. The war in Vietnam had ignited not just a radical anti-war movement, but a revolutionary movement. The civil rights movement that had started in earnest with the Montgomery bus boycott in 1955, led by women, Rosa Parks, in the beginning, had also radicalized the country. And then here you had a holiday, Professor Dickinson, that was actually had its origin in the United States and was celebrated almost in every country and certainly in every capital around the world, except people in the United States did not know about it. And similarly to May Day, International Workers' Day, May 1st, also had its origins in the United States in the struggle for the 8-hour day in Chicago, Illinois, and American workers didn't know about it. We got Labor Day instead of May Day. Let's just talk about why Americans didn't know about International Women's Day and what its origin actually was.
Well, you know, I think anti-communism and sexism probably cut right to the heart of that, Brian. As you were talking about, we've had these moments in U.S. history where working class women are leading struggles for liberation, both for women and for other oppressed peoples, and always for working class people, right? And that kind of energy, as we know, is deeply threatening to the U.S. government, the U.S. state, and, you know, sort of senses in the United States about who we are as a country. But I think it's really important to note that we've seen another sort of renewed interest in International Women's Day in the U.S. over the past, this will be the third year, we've seen women organizing under a banner of U.S. women strikes, as well as lots of other groups just claiming this as the holiday where progressive, anti-racist, trans-inclusive, anti-imperialist feminists get to come out and say, no, this is the kind of feminism that we need to win the future.
And it was started right here in New York in 1909. Well, not right here, but here on the East Coast. It was started here in the U.S. And it was also popularized due to the beginning, and it helped actually ignite the Russian Revolution in, I believe, 1917.
Right. I want to just go back about the Russian Revolution. People don't necessarily know this as well. That was a strike by women workers on International Women's Day in 1917. It was the old Russian calendar, but by our calendar, it would be March 8th. So women were out in the streets. They were locked out. They were locked out, and they started marching to other factories in St. Petersburg. And because those workers also were then locked out as punishment by their employers, the marches kept getting bigger and bigger. And 3 days later, the Tsar was gone. That was from a movement that began on International Women's Day. 8 months later, it led to the Bolshevik Revolution, the Socialist Revolution in October or November of 1917. Again, a part of history that Americans just don't know about this.
And I just would add that the demands for Russian women who began that strike on International Women's Day were for bread, an end to war, and an end to the monarchy. And I think it's so striking how in many ways those are the same or similar, right, demands to women today, right? We are paying attention to the social provisioning, right? The very basic things that people need to survive, food, a place to live, adequate health care. But we have our eye also on the international stage and U.S. imperialism right here in particular. And we see these kinds of echoes throughout the 20th and now the early 21st century of organized working class women standing up and saying, we're fighting not just for ourselves, but for the future of our society.
Similarly, the New York organizer who helped popularize and create National Women's Day was Teresa Malkiel. She was actually Russian born, but she organized with the Socialist Party of America. She was the first woman who kind of rose from working in factories and then into leadership in the Socialist Party. And she did a lot with helping to reform state labor laws. So she was a woman and a labor organizer. And she was, like you said, Hannah, you know, working for labor laws that the same things we're working on now. She was working in education. And she was also specifically looking at and trying to call attention to white supremacy within the U.S. And again, these are all issues that we're still working on. And these are just really important roots of this day.
Yeah.
Yeah. And one other piece of history to add is, just a couple years after that moment, Clara Zetkin, another Russian woman, along with other women throughout Europe, also called for International Women's Day to be recognized as a holiday. And so that's part of how we get the story of the transition of International Women's Day to Europe. But it was a part of the set of women's congresses where women all over Europe were coming together to meet and talk about the future of women's liberation. And so, again, I would just emphasize there's an important component of this history that's not just about women leading, but it's about women keeping their eye on both the importance of raised consciousness for women worldwide. It's about international solidarity with women worldwide, while also a struggle for material conditions and benefits, not just for women, but for the entire working class.
Also, China started recognizing International Women's Day in 1922, and you get half a day off in China for International Women's Day.
Today? I thought it was a full day.
Oh.
It isn't Cuba. Again, all around the world, International Women's Day is celebrated again officially. Now there's recognition in the United States. But again, this is a radical, young, anti-war, anti-racist women who got the ball rolling again in the United States in 1970. So so our audience gets a sense of this history, 100 years ago in 1909, women workers on demonstrations in New York City called by the Socialist Party of America, that was the first kind of Women's Day. And then in 1910, the Second International Socialist International Conference, recognizing what the women in New York were doing, proclaimed March 8th to be International Women's Day. Now, this really ignited a mass movement of women workers. Well, it didn't ignite it. It was part of a mass movement of women workers in New York City, in New England. There was the Bread and Roses strike. There was what was the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire of 1911. And I want to just bring this back in because this also fueled these big protests in New York City and around the country, again, around the struggle of labor and labor led by women. I want to read a couple sentences from the Smithsonian Museum, Smithsonian.com, about the Shirtwaist Fire. And I want to do this because that became a turning point not only for women workers, but for workers and for labor in general in the United States. So I want to read the first paragraph from the Smithsonian about this fire. Again, all part of that same period, 1909, 1910, 1911. On March 25th, 1911, a pleasant springtime afternoon, a fire broke out in a garment factory near Washington Square in New York City's Greenwich Village. If you go to Greenwich Village now, there's a big sort of monument to it. Within minutes, the entire eighth floor of a 10-story tower was full of flames. Onlookers, drawn by a column of smoke and the clamor of converging fire wagons, watched helplessly and in horror as dozens of workers screamed from the ninth floor windows. They were trapped by flames, a collapsed fire escape, and a locked door. Firefighters frantically cranked a rescue ladder, which rose slowly skyward, but then stopped at the sixth floor, fully extended. Pressed by the advancing blaze, workers began leaping and tumbling to their deaths on the sidewalk. Other workers perished in the flames. Still others plunged in an open elevator shaft, while behind the factory, two dozen fell behind the flimsy fire escape. In all, 146 workers, most of them immigrant young women and girls, perished in the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire. For 90 years, it stood as New York's deadliest workplace disaster. This led to a mass movement of women workers in the United States in the same time period, led by the Socialist Party, demanding a reform of factory conditions. Because, Professor Dickinson, one thing that people might not know about that is that the doors of the factory were locked and remain locked so that the workers couldn't get out because the bosses didn't want them to steal clothing materials or garments. Go ahead.
That's right. I think the locking of the doors, the poor labor conditions in the factory, they point to the ways in which the capitalist class, those factory owners then, those profiteers today, who are trying to eke as much profit as they can out of their workers, are of course, right, not oriented towards the rights or well-being of those workers. And so that's why the Shirtwaist Factory fire is such an important example, right, of first, the dangers when workers are not in a position, not able to organize and stand up for their rights, as we've seen, and we've seen consequences of anti-union and anti-organizing legislation throughout the U.S.'s history. But it also points to the necessity then of those workers getting organized and standing up, because once we recognize that our bosses are not, you know, there to take care of us, we understand it's our responsibility to take care of our fellow workers by fighting for our rights.
Professor Hannah Dickinson is our guest, along with Nicole Roussel. We're talking about women and society, as we do here on Loud and Clear in this special segment every Tuesday. before we move on to other issues, I want to just stay with the fire in 1911. It led to major reforms, real significant reforms and improvements for workers who were virtually slaves in these garment factories, still remain slaves in many ways, but, you know, wage slaves. But the conditions were so abominable. One of the young investigators of the fire was none other than Frances Perkins. Who was Frances Perkins? Frances Perkins was the first woman to serve as a U.S. in a U.S. cabinet position in American history. So here the country gets started in 1783. The Constitution is passed in 1787. No women are president, of course, but there were no women who were even functioning in an executive branch cabinet position until Frances Perkins. She became very well known as a consequence of her role investigating that fire and insisting on reforms for workers. And in 1933, she became FDR's Secretary of Labor. And what's most noteworthy about Frances Perkins is, as Secretary of Labor, just think about what she did in 1933 compared to all the other Secretaries of Labor who came later. She declared that workers have a property right to their job, meaning that the right to a job, the right to your job, was equivalent in terms of legal status with the rights of the employers. And that was extremely important because workers started engaging in mass strikes with the support, really, of people, rare people like Frances Perkins in the FDR cabinet, who were saying to workers who were being locked out and who were being laid off during the Great Depression, if you have a right to your job and the job is going to disappear because the bosses are going to shut down the factory or move it somewhere else, the implication is you have a right to fight for your job just as they have a contractual legal right to maintain the factory. There was a general strike in Minneapolis, San Francisco, and Toledo, Ohio in 1934. And starting in 1935, under the idea that workers' jobs were their right, the job was a right, they started sitting in and sitting down. And that was the wave of sit-down strikes in the mid-1930s that actually led to mass industrial unionization. The biggest and most important of the sit-down strikes, of course, coming from Flint, Michigan. When you think about where things were, say, in the FDR cabinet as it related to labor compared to what's 100 years later, you can see 100 years has not led to more progress. If anything, a huge backsliding. Anyway, let's just talk about the trajectory here. Go ahead, Hannah.
Well, so I'm first really glad that you emphasized the backsliding there, Brian. I think there's a way when we talk about this labor history, especially women's labor history at the beginning of the 20th century, it gets framed as, oh, women did this important work and now everything's great, right? But we can see with the anti-union legislation that we saw in Wisconsin in, must have been, what, 2011?
Yep.
That the teachers there responded really powerfully to. And then a whole slate of anti-union legislation over the last 20 years or so, I think helps explain why we're seeing the kind of massive pushback, especially from teachers and nurses and other folks who work in service sector and public sector jobs, right? It's not quite the same as your industrial strike. And yet it's crucially part of that very same history. And I know, you know, we've been talking on this segment a lot about the contemporary strikes and the ways in which they are women-led and people of color-led. And that they often get positioned as, right, the new face of labor. And, right, there's a way in which that's important to talk about the kinds of working conditions, the struggles for the common good have a slightly different shape, of course, in 2019. But there's a continuity there that I would say International Women's Day, right, helps us see that working class women have always been a part of labor movement in the U.S. and a part of the radical labor movement in the U.S. And certainly, right, we can think even further back in U.S. history about slave rebellions and other sites where women have been a crucial part of sort of right, mucking up the works of capitalism and fighting for better conditions for themselves, for other working class people. And as you were talking about, like, in some cases, to make visible, right, our very humanity.
Hannah, the fire we're talking about in 1911, the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire, reminds me a lot and has a lot of echoes of the fire just a few years ago in 2013 in Bangladesh, where over 1,000 garment workers died. It was almost the same exact circumstances with these huge warehouses where they were in factories where they were creating mostly women workers working in these impoverished sectors, making almost nothing every single day. Again, almost all women in these factories. And the doors were locked to keep people in so that they wouldn't leave because they weren't allowed to have breaks. They weren't allowed to leave. It is as close to slavery as you can get right now.
Yeah. You know, I'm glad you raised it, Nicole, because it's International Women's Day.
Exactly.
International Women's Day. This is a struggle. Workers around the world have something in common. Women have something in common, of course, because of patriarchy as a that arose at a certain stage in human society, and it dominates and has been sort of the enslavement of women everywhere.
And this enslavement, too, was for, you know, the high-end retailers in London and the U.S., right? These were people enslaved, working in these terrible conditions and then burning to death, over 1,000 of them, to make nice clothes for Western capitalists, right?
Exactly. Go ahead, Hannah.
I think two things to say about that really important example, Nicole. One, right, it just makes really visible that it's the garments being produced, it's the product that's getting sold to people in Europe, for example, that's valued over the lives of the workers, right? That could not be more clear. It is more important that our workers not steal these items than that we ensure that they live, right? So, I mean, that's the kind of struggle we're in. And so I think that example, helpfully points to it. But it also points to the ways precisely that that women's struggles are connected and speaks to the ways it's just so crucial, especially that women in the global north, in the US, in the UK, throughout Northern Europe, right, understand that the struggle for women's liberation can't just be for bourgeois or middle class or wealthy women, right? We can't measure women's liberation by how many CEOs are women, right? We can't measure by how many women are elected president of a particular place. It has to be about the quality of life and the freedoms of women everywhere. And it's crucial that we see the ways in which we're connected.
That's the voice of Hannah Dickinson. Hannah is a professor in Western New York. She's an organizer with the Geneva Women's Assembly. She joins us from Geneva, New York, every Tuesday. And we're also joined in studio by Nicole Roussel, a Sputnik news analyst and a producer of this show. Professor Dickinson, another big win for teachers. Again, women-led labor movement, this time in Oakland. Let's talk about it.
Yeah, so teachers in Oakland got many of the things they were asking for. They have pay raises over a series of years. They will see reductions in caseloads for some counselors and resource specialists. There will be some attention to reducing class sizes. So those are wins, right? That's because Oakland teachers were organized in solidarity with one another, in solidarity with teachers in surrounding school districts, and most importantly, working very closely with families and the community, right? So that's part of the story about how they're able to make this strike a successful one and win a contract that I think they're largely happy with. I do think that it's important to note that the Oakland teachers had some political demands, right? Some things, for example, like wanting to make sure to end school closures and wanting a more robust approach to class size reduction. And so I think really important that they were able to get those conversations into the strike conversations and into the national conversation about the strike. But I think we'll need to keep an eye on how some of those components develop for Oakland teachers. And I imagine they will be keeping an eye on those things too and remaining militant and committed to not just improved teaching and learning conditions in their own schools. But as part of this robust defense of public education that we've been seeing in teacher strike after teacher strike.
We're almost out of time, but I wanted to get to one more issue, Nicole.
Yeah, there's one more incredibly important issue about Congresswoman Ilhan Omar. This is an incredibly racist, sexist attack that's been
perpetrated.
Thank you, on Congresswoman Omar. Do you want to tell us about it real quick?
Sure. So in the same week when Congresswoman Omar is attacked by the West Virginia GOP in a really gross suggestion that she has something to do with 9/11, rather than come to her defense, the Democratic Party is calling for a resolution that's clearly targeted at her and at her honest articulations of the relationship between the U.S. and Israel. And she is being consistently attacked for being anti-Semitic in a way that other folks simply aren't, right? For saying very similar things or for saying white supremacist things. Yeah, I think there's no way to interpret this but a racist, sexist attack on a congresswoman who's standing up and saying the right thing.
Yeah, she's not anti-Semitic. That's not true. She's pointing out, as you have pointed out, Professor Dickinson, the truth about the influence and power of the pro-Israeli lobby. And it's not just the lobby from that's working with Israel, but of course, the military industrial complex excusing and giving a blank check for every crime committed by the Israeli government. And if you criticize that, as she did, you're called an anti-Semite. Anyway, we're completely out of time. We were joined, as we are every Tuesday, by Professor Hannah Dickinson. She is a professor in Western New York and an organizer with the Geneva Women's Assembly. And we were joined here in studio by Nicole Russell, a Sputnik News analyst and a producer of this show. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Today we continue our weekly series called False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey. We're joined from San Francisco by Daniel Sankey. He is a financial policy analyst. Daniel, welcome back.
Thank you.
Daniel Sankey, what's new in the world of the economy? We have Amazon, of course. That's right at the top of the news. Let's start there.
Yeah, I think this one's especially topical. The New York Times did a pretty good report on Amazon in the wake of its backing out of the Queen's deal in New York. So what they did is they kind of dug into sort of how Amazon has effectively used its, you know, vast resources to bully and pressure different states into acquiescing to its demands and giving it highly preferential treatment. You know, there's a kind of whole laundry list of examples, but I think one of the most telling is in 2010, Amazon had to pay a tax bill of $270 million in back taxes for sales tax that it hadn't paid. And Texas, you know, tax officials were pressuring Amazon to make this payment. And it responded by closing its only warehouse in the state and canceling all plans to expand to more warehouses. So it effectively laid off, you know, that workforce there. And then under that pressure, 2 years later, these tax officials agreed to waive the past taxes in exchange for Amazon opening new warehouses. So Amazon effectively got this $270 million tax break, which I'm kind of amazed that this sort of stuff is legal. It just doesn't seem like you could just get your taxes waived, you know, be at someone's discretion, that it has to go through some kind of more of a process than that. But in this case, perhaps it did, or perhaps there aren't those controls. But I think, you know, it goes on to talk about in South Carolina, Amazon refused to stop hiring people in 2011 because South Carolina didn't want to give it a sales tax break, because that's a big thing it's been trying to avoid, which actually I think we should talk about too. And basically is using its kind of job creation in those areas as a way to bully the communities there so that it doesn't have to pay its fair share, so that it doesn't have to reinvest in the community that made the money that it makes in that state, and essentially trying to push back against sales tax, which is a big topic right now, because Amazon has always argued that because it's an online company, it's, you know, it's in cyberspace, that it doesn't really have an obligation to collect sales tax from customers. So when customers go onto Amazon and they don't collect the sales tax, and this causes a reduction in tax revenue revenue for the various states it operates in. They say it's up to someone else to enforce it, or it's up to the customers to pay it, or it's basically not their problem. And this is something that, you know, it's argued very effectively. And you can see even in instances where states didn't buy it and said, no, you owe us sales tax. You're making money off of, you know, people in our area. Therefore, you owe us taxes. It will then shut down operations, lay off large numbers of people, and threaten to, you know, essentially exit the state. So what it did in New York, was really under pressure from a lot of grassroots resistance of people in Queens who didn't want to see their community gentrified and then pushed out, which was a very excellent thing and had a progressive component to it. But also Amazon has this sort of bullying kind of temper tantrum mentality when it comes to using its jobs and its outside influence to not have to pay its fair share, to not have to reinvest in the communities. And I think this is a topic that's really well worth discussing.
I agree with you. What we're witnessing is the destructive impact of the tendency towards monopoly. You know, Amazon was an online retailer. It's branching out. I'm just looking at a headline here. CNBC: grocery store stocks take a beating on report that Amazon will launch its own chain of supermarkets. So they bought Whole Foods. They started to make their move. They're going to make their own supermarkets. They destroyed all the bookstores in America.
And in fact, just this week, the Washington Post reported that Barnes & Noble is likely to go out of business. That when Amazon first appeared on the horizon, Barnes & Noble tried to partner with them. Bezos wasn't interested in a partnership. At that time, Barnes & Noble, Borders, and Books A Million had 80% of the book market. Now, Barnes & Noble has under 20% of the book market, and they have only 0.05% of the ebook market. Now Amazon is the king. And we should also remember, too, that as recently as the Reagan presidency, corporate taxes were in the 50% range. This mania about cutting taxes is relatively new.
Yeah. I mean, if you think back about it, and let's just keep on this topic of monopoly, because Amazon is perhaps the biggest sort of symptom of the trend of monopoly. And I consider monopoly to be a disease of capitalism, but an inherent feature of capitalism. Now, just think about what happened. Barnes & Noble and these big mega corporations, bookstore corporations, they put out of business the small bookstore owners because they couldn't compete with them in volume.
Volume.
Right?
Yep.
And so with volume, you can lower the price. So they undersold the small guy, the small middle class, small entrepreneur, bookstore owner. They put them out of business. Then Amazon comes along and starts selling books online at a lower price than the mega corporations like Barnes & Noble, and they're driven out of business. And now you go to Bethesda, there was a huge Barnes & Noble up there.
It anchored the city center.
It's gone.
Gone.
It's gone. Now, right down the street in Bethesda, for people who don't know, it's a little suburb, affluent suburb just north of Washington, D.C., right down the street from where the Barnes & Noble megastore was up until about a year ago, there's now an Amazon bookstore. So Amazon went from an online retail giant selling books, underselling books. So it undercut the biggest corporations who already had undercut the small bookstore owners. So at the end of the day, bookstore owners get knocked out by the big corporations, then the big corporations get knocked out by even bigger corporations.
And then they raise the prices.
They raise the prices, and also they're laying off workers as they go along. So communities lose these sort of anchoring. A bookstore is an anchor of a community. I mean, in New York City, when I first moved to New York City in the 70s, you know, there was like scores of bookstores. They're all gone. I mean, in Manhattan, they're almost all gone. This is the monopoly trend, and we could talk about more than just retail, but let's stay with it. Why this happens? Why is this, in spite of everyone's understanding that this is a bad thing for people or for small businesses, why does it keep happening?
Yeah, I think what we're seeing really is this kind of relentless profit drive, which is what, of course, drives Amazon, is to make every single tiny penny possible, whether it's by pressuring states into waiving its taxes so that and it gets to keep that money for itself and give it to its executives, or in the case of undercutting brick and mortar places and then taking their place. I mean, bookstores are, you know, have a close place to my heart. When I was a kid, I loved hanging out at them all the time. And there was a number of small, independent little mom and pop bookstores in my town. And I would go to and hang out there and, drink coffee and read books and talk with friends, et cetera. And there are really kind of little cultural landmarks, you know, when you talk about New York City, these little small businesses that have their own unique quality that are really part of the community, where the people who work there also walk a couple blocks home or live in the same community. And it becomes a gathering point for people, especially in bookstores, as an opportunity to discuss ideas, to debate things, to engage, you know, with literary works. It's really not just about acquiring a commodity, i.e. a book, and then moving on your way. It's really more about the kind of social and cultural character of that particular space, which, of course, Amazon is completely wiping out, right? Amazon wants this kind of shiny, homogenous bookstore that you don't even talk to people in there because humans don't work there, just machines. They scan your ID card as you come in and know to, you know, charge your credit card X amount of dollars for the books that you walked out. You're being monitored and screened the whole time by a variety of cameras that are up in all the corners. You know, robots move around and restock shelves. And it really is the kind of like dehumanization of these social spaces where human beings are really pushed out and not part of them. This, you know, this is the world that Amazon is seeking to create, a world where the Amazon logo is kind of everywhere. And there's been different movies that have parodied that and kind of joked around about it. But the truth is, that's very much what it's seeking to do. That's very much the kind of world that it's seeking to create. I think also, you know, when we talk about it pulling jobs from different regions, you know, jobs, to have jobs controlled by a single entity like Amazon is extremely dangerous, because the truth is we all need jobs. Jobs are not optional. We didn't, you know, wake up and decide, well, do I want to be a worker or do I want to, you know, I don't know, be independently wealthy? Of course not. We have to enter the workforce to feed ourselves, to feed our families, to put a roof over our head, et cetera. And when Amazon has this incredible monopoly power, they control something everyone needs. So in a way, I kind of don't blame the legislature or the tax people in Texas or South Carolina, because what's the alternative? You know, thousands of their citizens get laid off and now are unemployed and all the, you know, social problems that that creates downstream, they're kind of put in a chokehold. And so they do, you know, they choose the least negative option out of a number of negative options in trying to preserve some people's jobs and trying to bring more economic growth to their community. So you can't be too angry at them given Amazon's outside influence. But when this happens, this kind of destabilizes our sort of traditional capitalist narrative, which is that we have a whole bunch of small producers, loosely regulated, competing with each other, quickly producing lowest prices, best possible commodities for consumers, et cetera. So in, you know, our capitalist narrative, there should be someone to take Amazon's place, right? That when Amazon says, well, we don't want to do business there, a whole bunch of other businesses should swarm in and say, well, no, we'll take that place. We want that market. We'll open up a bookstore or a shoe store or whatever, you know, is being sold there. But the truth is, this monopoly that has broken so many of these small businesses makes it impossible for that to happen. So no one comes to replace it. And they're effectively left, you know, with kind of an economic hole in that region, which is what we're seeing here. It's incredibly disruptive to the economy. It makes record unbelievable profits for Amazon, but it hurts everyone else. And it even hurts the kind of, you know, capitalist economic fiber here by preventing that same sort of fluidity, innovation, low prices, et cetera, that capitalism supposedly promises us. It completely disrupts that and prevents it from happening.
John, you know, I'm a socialist. I'm talking about socialism a lot. Socialism is a bigger issue now in the United States than it used to be in the past because of the post-World War II era, the Cold War. Socialist ideas were not tolerated. You know, basically, if you were a socialist and you were an enemy agent of you were the fifth column of an enemy power that had thermonuclear weapons pointed at the United States. Now, after the Cold War, people are talking, well, should it be this policy or that policy, this system or that system? You have Bernie Sanders just last weekend in Chicago and Brooklyn. Again, thousands of people coming out to support his message. He's giving his own definition to what socialism is. But one of the things that happens is that in the propaganda, say, of people like Donald Trump, who's making socialism or anti-socialism a cornerstone to his campaign, that socialism deprives people of the freedom, of individual freedom, and that capitalism is the free market, and thus people have the freedom to start a business, to be entrepreneurs, to take initiative, to take risk, you know, that kind of line. But when you look at the big picture here, small businesses in America are being destroyed every day not by the state, not by the intervention of a socialist policy. They're being smashed, crushed by bigger capital and by this process of monopoly where small businesses just can't compete.
Well, on the show, maybe 6 or 8 months ago, we talked about an article written by a man who was a tech entrepreneur and had come up with some sort of a chat app. Sure enough, he gets a call from Mark Zuckerberg. Fly on out to California. They flew him out first class. They went to dinner. They hung out. The guy said he couldn't believe that Mark Zuckerberg was romancing him to talk about his company. And then the next day, the bottom line came, and it was, we want to buy your company. The guy told Zuckerberg, thanks, but no thanks. You know, this is our big growth period right now. I want to keep running it myself. Next thing he knew is Facebook came up with the same technology and drove him out of business. He lost everything. And the technology that he had developed was essentially absorbed into Facebook Messenger. So that's what these big companies do. You can allow them to take you over. And if you don't, they'll crush you and they'll take you over anyway.
Go ahead, Daniel.
That's a really important part of what we're seeing here is that person, rather than being allowed to compete in the so-called free market, was simply absorbed and crushed, not because he couldn't compete with Facebook, but because Facebook was able to essentially steal his ideas and sell them instead. And Facebook, of course, has much larger, you know, reach than he has. You know, when Brian talked about socialism and people, you know, exploring different kind of economic orders, you know, he's right. Socialism is not destroying our economy. And that's because there is no socialism in this economy. So any problems that are happening right now, any issues that we're experiencing in the United States and any economic problems can't be laid at the feet of socialism. You know, the Washington talking heads like to do that. But how could you possibly blame an economic system which has no presence here in the United States? All the problems we're right now dealing with have been created by capitalism. That is the undisputed dominant economic model we have right now. And trying to blame one that has no place here is ridiculous. Secondarily, we need to say that these are capitalist problems that we're creating, that the system we use and implement is creating these problems. We can't say in some idealized way that it's not really capitalism or it's not true, pure capitalism. A lot of libertarians are fond of making that argument. No, this is capitalism because capitalism isn't an idea. It's an economic system that's put in history. And that's what we're in the middle of right now. So any of the real problems in history by historical system on planet Earth, here in time and not in our minds and our heads, is what capitalism is. This is capitalism, and these are the problems that it's creating. One of the things that likes to get brought up a lot is, you know, capitalism protects and promotes the individual. But the truth is, the individual is a complete fiction. There is no such thing as an individual. I'm speaking a language to you right now that I was taught by other people, that was created by a community. That's the only way we can understand each other. We're using machines to have this, you know, radio show that were created by many other people who are much smarter than we are. And I could not possibly think to create this machine on my own. I am a social creature. I'm created by a community that has come together and produced me. And every human being is like this. There's no such thing as an individual human being all by himself, because those would have died immediately, you know, in prehistoric times, eaten by wolves or something like that. So this idea that somehow we need to protect individuals or preserve individuality, there is no such thing as an individual. There is only social creatures part of a greater network. And that's what we're seeing here. But the problem is, when we talk about protecting the individual, what that inevitably comes to is protecting the individuals at Amazon who control Amazon, Jeff Bezos. We need to protect his individuality. And he's gotten to such a big point that, you know, you can live under the illusion that somehow all by himself he did this and all by himself he creates wealth, which is, of course, ludicrous. But that ideology creates this tremendous problem where a tiny group of people at Amazon control all the things we need, whether it's commodities that are delivered to our doorstep, books, news, they control the Washington Post, or jobs in the case of all these different communities that watch their jobs vanish. This is a serious problem. It makes human life less livable, less just, less pleasant than it could be when these essential things are shared and produced by the community as opposed to produced by the community and controlled by a tiny group of people.
Yeah, I'm glad we're spending enough time on this. You know, we talk every week with Daniel Sankey about the big financial policy issues and the developments, the news of the week, so to speak. But it's really important for people to think about the economy differently from this spoon-fed, like, small, sort of superficial things that are handed out on TV by pundits, because they're just going along with so-called conventional wisdom. And conventional wisdom is actually manufactured by the same opinion molding corporations that own the media. And of course, it's in their interest for people to think that the system we live in and the way these economic policies work are more or less mandated. There's almost have the stature of being God-given, that they're immutable, or that they're the crowning achievement of human society, that the economy is the best that it can possibly be. Any defects that it has are sort of anomalous, they're secondary, they're peripheral. When in fact, we're experiencing something that goes to the core of the economy, and the economy isn't mandated, it's not from God, it's a creature of human beings, and these human beings have different interests. And some of the interests are like Jeff Bezos' interests.
That's right.
And some of the interests are like the people who work for Jeff Bezos or who used to work at that small bookstore that's been put out of business. So it's really about us. It's about what we want to do, what kind of life we want to lead, what kind of economy we want to have. Again, not immutable, perfectly changeable. Again, what Amazon is doing in essence is functioning as a tyrannical force. And I don't want to simply demonize Jeff Bezos, because if Jeff Bezos, let's say he passed away, let's say he had a terrible accident, passed away, whatever, there'd be a new group of people who would take over, and the corporation would be operated fundamentally on the same premise, because if they're not doing that which they must do to maximize profit, they won't continue to draw investor capital into the enterprise. That capital will go elsewhere. So the system itself requires the maximizing of profit for those who can attract capital, which means wipe out small business, wipe out workers, eliminate high wages, don't give them benefits, don't give them a pension, and make sure that you're selling a product in a way that's underselling your competition, if possible, so that you can beat the competition out, destroy them in the marketplace, and then eat them up. You know, they either go bankrupt or they get consolidated under your presence. And if you don't do that, somebody else will do it. So these are the laws of a particular economic system. So I would say, in summary, after this rant, Jeff Bezos is in many ways a symptom, but the disease is the monopoly stage of this particular economic order. Anyway, I think that really speaks to the issue of trying to fashion a radical policy. You know, radical means getting to the roots. Doesn't mean just being wild and crazy-eyed. It means getting to the roots of the problem. This is the root of the problem. Let's get your final comments, Daniel, on this issue, the issue of monopoly, and then we'll go on to some of the other big issues.
Yeah, I think you make a good point, Brian, when you say it's systemic. It's not just Jeff Bezos on his own. It's part of an overall system. And I think, you know, I work in the tech industry, and there's a lot of, you know, young, idealistic people who really do want to make kind of this compassionate capitalism or these compassionate corporations that actually care about people and try to make lives different because, you know, they genuinely want to see things improve. But what they're always confronted by is the fact that the system itself is extremely unjust, and it is a necessary part of success. So if you even had a capitalist, corporation owner who was just incredibly big-hearted and generous and just gave huge salaries and bonuses and income to his employees, well, then the other capitalist that decided not to do that and grind down his employees and pull everything back, that capitalist would make more money. And investors would flock to him, and the guy that was giving everybody, you know, their money back would quickly go out of business because he's not giving it to investors. So it's not even really a moral choice. Even in that case, that person made a more moral decision and yet went out of business. So it's really important to talk about that this is systemic. It's not just individual people making choices. It's us as a community deciding how we want to organize the wealth. And that's something that needs to be discussed.
Let's go on to the next issue. Trump said he wants more highly skilled immigrants to come to the U.S. What's the story?
Yeah, this story is really interesting. So I think it bears talking a little bit about immigration because that's obviously been such a big deal under this administration. And, what the article says is that Trump is claiming that he wants more highly skilled immigrants coming to the United States on what's called H-1B visas. And these are highly skilled, we're thinking scientists, engineers, technologists, people for whom there's a lack of U.S. residents that are that possess those skills. And so we're trying to kind of import it, or companies are trying to import it from overseas. And so H-1B visas are for these immigrants that are allowed to work here for a period of time because they bring this special skill set. And Donald Trump has tweeted and said numerous times, no, I want these sort of immigrants. These aren't the immigrants that I hate. These people should come. But what the article in Business Insider goes on to show is that actually they are the bureaucratic kind of apparatus that approves and gives these H-1B visas is really overwhelmingly declining, delaying, slowing down these processes such that a lot of these applicants, these immigrants who previously would have kind of sailed through quickly are being forced to return home. They're not getting renewals. They're not getting the first approval. And I think this is a sign of sort of this kind of fight that's going on at the height of power. You know, the truth is the demonization of immigrants and the other is a really fundamental part of American culture. And there are corporations that make tremendous amount of money on that. You know, I think of agribusiness, who, because their workforce is largely immigrants, who many don't speak the language, don't have an organic connection to the United States, they can really exploit. Because if you underpaid them or didn't give them wages or didn't have insurance if they hurt themselves or something like that, what are they going to do? They're not going to go to law enforcement or anything like that because they'll probably be deported. So the demonization of immigrants isn't so much to push them out, but to push down their wages. But there's downstream effects because you can't just limit racism at that. Racism then spreads to highly skilled immigrants who are now also being pushed out. And there are corporations, especially in the tech industry, that are very hurt by that and really want to see more of an influx of this immigrant labor because there's such a lack of technical skills here that it needs to be brought in from overseas. And so what you're seeing is a lot of conflict kind of at the top between different, very wealthy corporate powers over the question of immigrants because, you know, for example, the tech industry really cozied up to Obama and was very close to that administration, planned on Hillary Clinton just kind of being his successor, and they'd continue that very cozy relationship with Washington. But when Trump came to power, he really cracked down on the tech industry, who, of course, was highly hostile to him. And so now we're seeing this conflict being played out. And unfortunately, at the end of the day, this fight between these kind of corporate powers through Washington, immigrants are the ones who get hurt, whether highly skilled or so-called lesser skilled immigrants are the ones that ultimately are getting pushed out and seeing their kind of dreams and opportunities die.
Daniel Senke is our guest. He's a financial policy analyst. He joins us every Tuesday in this segment of Loud and Clear. You're in California. PG&E delayed safety work on power line that is prime suspect in California wildfire. For 5 years, PG&E repeatedly delayed a safety overhaul of a century-old high-voltage transmission line that is the prime suspect behind the deadliest wildfire in California history. Anybody going to jail?
Don't count on it.
Not yet. That isn't even up for discussion, at least in this article. So the Caribou-Palermo line, as it's called, is a century-old power line that cuts through a large portion of California and provides power to many communities there. In 2010, different regulatory bodies said that it is starting to get overcapacity and it needs to be replaced within the next 8 years. The regulatory body also said that 8 years was ample time, that you could easily do it in less. So they gave it very fair warning. And PG&E continued to defer those repairs year after year after year, and not actually start them until, of course, most recently, it resulted in this horrific, you know, wildfire, which claimed so many lives and destroyed so many homes. So what it shows is, you know, that the PG&E behaved completely unethically, completely negligently, and rather than spending money that it received from taxpayers through different appropriations it got from the government, rather than using that to rebuild these lines and meet regulatory maintenance, it used it on something else. It used it on other projects, or it kicked it up to CEOs and executive members. I mean, the worst part is we don't exactly know what they did with the money. It's not really being clearly audited. So, but whatever it wasn't used to repair the power lines. I think it shows the lack of accountability and oversight over this particular corporation in the in California, a corporation who's so essential to our functioning, that regulators haven't really been given any teeth to actually go in and do much, that it takes something that involves, huge lawsuits, the loss of so many lives, for us to actually go in and do something about it.
People died. So many homes were wiped out. Whole communities were wiped out.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, if like an, quote, average person did this to a community, people would go to prison, minimally.
And in the past, people have gone to prison. You know, if you're caught playing with matches, or you don't put a campfire out or whatever it is, and they do this investigation and they find you, you're going to go to prison for manslaughter, for reckless endangerment, for whatever. This case shouts out for PG&E executives to be prosecuted for this fire.
Yeah, that's right. Being rich and powerful should not be immunity.
That's a great point. I mean, there was a couple that did a gender reveal party for their baby, and it started a fire because there was some fireworks, and their faces were splattered everywhere. They were demonized, and they'll face some criminal charges.
Wow.
PG&E did way worse than that, and at least you could say that couple, it was purely on accident, whereas PG&E was clearly negligence. And so, yeah, that shows the kind of tyranny of wealth and the tyranny of the rich, where if you're an average person, you're going to face manslaughter, and if you're a PG&E executive, you just quit the company and go elsewhere with a golden parachute.
That was Daniel Sankey. Daniel joins us every Tuesday in this segment on Loud and Clear called False Profits, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and you want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day in the Washington, D.C. area, Monday through Friday from 4 to 6 p.m. at 105.5 FM and 1390 AM. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. Stay tuned to Radio Sputnik.
Loud and clear.